is one of the problems there. And one of the things about dependent origination, you find in the suttas, this was a discussion between the Buddha and Venerable Ananda. You know Venerable Ananda, he was the main attendant of the Buddha. And they were, Venerable Ananda went to the Buddha and he said to the Buddha, "Oh, you know, this dependent origination is as clear to me as clear can be here." And the Buddha says, "Don't say that. Don't say these things. This is very profound. And it's very difficult for a dependent origination to be that clear to anybody." And this was Venerable Ananda. He is one of the Buddha's main disciples, one of the wisest people in the whole of the Sangha. And even for him, the Buddha said, it is difficult to understand this topic fully. But still, even though the full understanding may be hard, to get actually some benefit out of this, to understand the main principles, may not be that impossible. So let us see what happens with this. Now, I'll give you a chance to ask questions afterwards as well. So let me just start with just going through dependent origination. Dependent origination is a series of 12 factors, each one linking to the next one. Okay? So 12 factors, one linking to the next one. So what are these 12 factors that link up in this series? Well, the first one is called ignorance, usually called ignorance. And really what it really means is that you don't understand the world in the way the world actually is. So probably more appropriate to say maybe it's delusion or misunderstanding or a kind of, you know, faulty view of the world is probably a more appropriate way of looking at it. So this is what ignorance is, or avidya in the Pali language. Once you have ignorance, then what you start to do things, you start to actually get involved in the world, you start to do actions. And these actions that you do as a consequence of ignorance, this is called kamma. You're creating kamma for yourself. And of course, one of the foundational things of the Buddhist teachings is that if you do create kamma, you can expect a rebirth in the future. So the next step here is consciousness. This is consciousness arising as a consequence of the kamma that you're doing now. And consciousness can be like established in different levels depending on the type of kamma you have. So the consciousness can be either very high in a very beautiful place, or it can also be established in a very low place because of the bad kamma you have. As a consequence of where the consciousness is established, you will experience different things depending on where the consciousness actually is. So if the consciousness is in a certain place, you will have certain experiences. If it is established somewhere else, you will have other experiences. And this is called nama rupa. Nama rupa basically means something like, nama actually means name quite literally. But this is a reference to the different mental aspects of a person. And these different mental aspects will actually vary depending on where that rebirth takes place. And also the body, the rupa, this means like form, and essentially in this context means like the physical body and perhaps other form as well. It is the form you have, the body you have, will also depend on where that consciousness is established. Then, because of that type of rebirth you have, the type of experience you have, there is different input through the senses. You have a certain type of sensory experiences. Now, this is called the six senses. The six senses are a function of that nama rupa, of the name and form. So you experience different things through the senses. The senses that you have will have certain characteristics depending on the body that you have. Now, once you have senses, there is like contact through those senses. Contact means that you experience things through the senses. When you have an eye, you will see, right? When you have an ear, you will hear. When you have a body, you will feel things. This is the nature of having these senses. So there is contact with the world. It's like the world, you and the world make an interaction between you and the world. This is the meaning of contact. When there is contact, when there is that interaction, you will experience feelings. Feelings in this case means either it's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. It doesn't mean emotions. It means whether the experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That is a consequence of, and every time you have an interaction with the world, every time you see something, every time you hear something, every time you touch something, there is an experience, a feeling, a sensation that is associated with that experience through the senses. Because you have feelings, it either hurts or it's neutral or it's pleasant, you have a craving associated with that feeling. If it's pleasant, you think, yeah, great, let's have more of that. If it's painful, you think, oh, let's try to get rid of that, right? This is craving. Your craving is associated with feeling. When you have feeling, what happens? You tend to attach to things. When you have craving, you tend to attach to things. Because you crave for this and that experience, you try to control the world in a certain way so you can have all your cravings satisfied. So you attach, you get into relationships, you do all kinds of things to get craving satisfied. This is called upadana, attachment, or clinging, if you like. Now then, if you have this upadana, you tend to live in a certain way. You live in accordance with what you take up. You live in accordance with the views you have and all this kind of things. So you live in a certain way. When you live in a certain way, you make kamma, again, in accordance with the way that you live. And then when you make kamma in accordance with the way that you live, then you get reborn. This is next one is jati. Jati means birth. And you get reborn in accordance with the kamma that you make. And then once you're born, well then, you get old eventually. Hopefully you get old. If you don't get old, it's even worse. But if hopefully you get old. And then when you get old, you die. And then, of course, you have all the problems with life because you have been born. So that is, in very, very brief, what dependent origination is all about. So have you got it now? Does it make sense? Okay. So I'll explain a little bit more detail because it is, you know, it probably doesn't make all that much sense what you've heard so far, but it gives you a rough idea what is going on here. So to understand what this is all about, let's start at the very end of dependent origination. The last factor of dependent origination is suffering, right? Old age, death and suffering. This is the very last link. This is where it ends. Actually, before I do this, I should say something else first. And then I should explain what it is between each of these 12 things. I said there is a causality. One thing leads to the next one, right? And what does that mean? What is that link between each of these things? How are they actually linked up? Now, this is actually a very important principle, and I have to explain that first. Otherwise, it's going to get even more confusing here. So what is it? Why is it that one thing leads to the next one? What does that mean? Now, this is the law of causality according to Buddhism. And in the English language, there are some very good words that explain very well what is going on here. And these two words, and don't get put off by the difficulty of these words, because they may sound very unfamiliar to you, but there's two words. One is called a sufficient cause, and the other one is called a necessary cause. Now, if those two things mean that if something is a sufficient cause for something else, it means that if the one thing is there, then the other thing must happen as a result.
Sorry, interruption. Car number SCN 6148 SGL123. Can you kindly shift your car? It's blocking.
Okay, thank you. I thought it was a complaint or something, but very. Okay, good. So, what I'm saying here is that this causality is a sufficient causality. In other words, once you have one of these things, once you have ignorance, you must have sankhara number two, which is the creation of kamma. Once you have sankhara, you must have consciousness, which is the rebirth consciousness I was talking about before. So each of these links is a sufficient cause for the one which comes afterwards. So once you have ignorance at the beginning, once you have delusion, once you have avidya, the whole 12 links come into existence all the way up to suffering. So ignorance, once it's there, is a sufficient cause for suffering. Once you have ignorance, you must have suffering as a consequence. There's no choice. That is what that first aspect of this causality means, sufficient causality. There is a necessary sequence there. And there's another aspect to this causality that is called necessary causality. A necessary causality is almost like the reverse. So what happens, let's say that you practice the Buddhist path, like you probably all know that part of the Buddhist path is about overcoming ignorance and seeing things as it actually is and becoming wise and all these kind of things. Wonderful, wonderful things to become wise. So what happens, let's say you become so wise that there is no ignorance anymore. And what happens then? This is where we see the necessary causality. if you take away ignorance, then the second step in these 12 things also ceases, ends as a consequence of that. And this is what we mean by necessary causality. Ignorance is necessary for the second one. If you take away ignorance, the second step cannot occur, because it is required for the second step to exist. So what that means is that as soon as ignorance ceases to exist, then sankhara, the volition, the kamma you're making, must also cease. When that ceases, consciousness must also cease, etc., etc., all the way up to suffering. So if there is no ignorance, suffering also must come to an end. So this is how this works. There's two types of causality. One works in the sense that if one exists, the rest must exist. The other one is if one does not exist, none of the other can exist as a consequence. And this shows you, what this shows you is that as long as there is ignorance there, as long as there is delusion there, you must suffer. There's no choice in the matter here. Take away the ignorance, take away delusion, suffering will definitely come to an end. And that is very useful to know, because it shows us what we have to do as human beings if we want to end suffering. So what is this thing we call suffering? We begin at the very end of the path, at the end of these 12 links rather. So what is this suffering all about? Now, the reason why it's very handy to understand the suffering is that the whole purpose of dependent origination, it ends in suffering. So what it means is that this is what dependent origination is pointing towards. It's pointing towards suffering. This is the purpose, in a sense, of dependent origination. It ends there. So it is about suffering and how it comes to exist. Of course, it's a very nice thing to know something about suffering and why it comes to exist, because this is the stuff we want to get rid of. So this is obviously very important for us as human beings. So suffering is, as I said before, it is old age, it is death, and then it's suffering in general. Old age, we all know, actually we don't probably all know, but it's very hard to know when you're young. But if you think about old age is like when you lose your ability to, you know, your eyes start to fail, your hearing starts to fail, your legs fail, your body is starting to fall apart. Sometimes it's very good to meet somebody who is very old, like a grandparent or something, and have a chat with them and ask them what it feels like to get really, really old. And they will tell you it is not a very pleasant thing to get very old. Before, you were independent, you were in charge of yourself, you could do what you wanted, and suddenly you are dependent on everybody else to, you know, wheel you around and sort you out and clean you up and all these kind of things, and you're completely at the mercy of other people, so to speak. If you have a good family, it's great, because they will look after you. If you haven't got a very good family, it's even more suffering, because you have to be taken care of by others, etc. So this is the problem with old age. It actually is a serious problem. And the very fact that it is mentioned here is obviously very significant. Old age is difficult, basically. Even more difficult is death. Again, it's interesting why it is that death is mentioned separately like this. And essentially it is because death is one of the most difficult things for human beings to experience. It's very hard, because we have spent the whole life accumulating things, getting possessions that are close to us, accumulating friends, having a family members that are very dear to us. And now we have to let go of absolutely everything. Right? We spend the whole life making these things, and then we have to let go. Now that is hard. It is very difficult. And that is why death is so hard for people. But even worse, we even have to let go of our own body. You know, you spend your whole life, you know, pumping weights and running around and using makeup and, you know, nice clothes and all this kind of stuff. And then you have to chuck it all out afterwards. Now, that is, again, it's difficult. You become attached to your body if you sort of always look after it and sort of, think it is very important. So that is also a difficulty. So death is actually a difficult thing for human beings. And that is why it is singled out specifically here in dependent origination. And then there is the general suffering of life that you have in every day, that you always come around with you. The fact that people say things to you that are not nice. The fact that you have pains in the body. The fact that all the things in daily life that are unpleasant, the tiny little things, from pain and meditation practice to, you know, somebody really, you know, cutting off your arm or something like that, or and everything in between. So this is the pain of life. Now, what dependent origination then says is that the cause of this pain of life, the cause of suffering, is birth. The cause of suffering is not that you haven't got it right. The cause of suffering is that you haven't, isn't that you haven't tried hard enough to do things in the right way. The cause of suffering is birth, and it's a very profound thing, because it means that it's not about how you live your life, whether you live your life in this way or you live your life in that way. It means that once you are born, you've had it, basically. That's what it means. Once you're born, you're stuffed, as they say. You know, it means that you will suffer once you've been born. Birth is the problem. It's not about how you live. It's the fact of birth that is the problem. Now, this is very profound things, and for those of you who are new, you may think I'm slightly nuts or something for saying these kind of things. But this is the Buddha's teaching. It is inescapable that once you are born, you will have to have suffering in your life. And in one way, you can relax a little bit when you know that, because always we try to get things right and get, you know, not get things wrong and try to sort things out and have happiness. But when you realize that actually it isn't your fault, you can't really sort it out, it means you can relax a bit more and say, okay, suffering happens. This is the way things are. This is the way it has to be. And so in one way, there is a positive aspect to that as well here. So the problem is then birth. Birth is what actually gives rise to this whole thing. What is meant by birth here? What is actually meant by birth here is rebirth. Because this birth and dependent origination has links before it. And obviously what happens before birth must have happened in the past life. So this is birth here means rebirth. So this is one of the things. One other thing that is also interesting, you will find in other suttas like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta of the Buddha. This is just a little bit of a side issue, the sort of thing that is interesting, I find very fascinating. The Buddha says, well, actually, birth too is suffering. Yeah. So why is it that birth is suffering? It's one of those questions which is a bit of a conundrum. Birth is suffering. Okay, sure, you know, getting born probably isn't very pleasant. You're very safe and nice in your mother's womb, but then you have to come into the cold world. That is obviously, you know, there's some suffering involved in that. But is that all that is meant by birth is suffering? Yeah. And one of the reasons why birth is suffering is, of course, that, well, first of all, you come into the world and the world is suffering. Yeah. But there's another thing about birth is suffering, and that is the fact when, imagine what you may have read about near-death experiences, what you have read about out-of-body experiences. People say getting out of the body is such a great and wonderful thing. You're free of this burden, you're free of all the pains of the body, and for the first time in your life, you feel really free and you feel easy, you feel relaxed, you feel really good about yourself. Now here the reverse is happening here. You are free, everything is nice, and then you get crammed into this tiny little body in your mother's womb. Right? This is what is happening here. It's a reverse thing here. You get sort of put into this thing here, and you don't really want to be there. So the very fact that you actually, that this happens, you get kind of, you know, you get established in this physical thing, which is quite difficult and painful. That is, I think, a important aspect here of why birth is suffering. Birth here doesn't just mean like physical birth, it means like the arising in a new life. So arising in your mother's womb, if you're a human being, or any other type of arising here. So this is the end of dependent origination. This is what dependent origination is pointing at. It's pointing at suffering here. This is the purpose of this dependent origination. The whole sequence is pointing at this. So this is as I said, very significant, because this is one thing we want to resolve. So because this is pointing at suffering, it means that here we see the opportunity to resolving this issue. And to resolve it, we have to get rid of birth or rebirth. That is the problem, because that is the cause of this suffering here. So let's now look at the other end of dependent origination. So this is like the end, the far end point. So what is the near end point? What is the first causality, the first factor that starts this whole thing off? And the first factor that starts this whole thing off is then this avidya, lack of understanding or ignorance, if you like. So what is meant by this ignorance? And essentially what it means is the misunderstanding of the world, seeing the world in the wrong way, not seeing the world in accordance with the way it actually is, but seeing it with like tinted glasses, seeing something which isn't quite there. And two aspects in particular which is important of that misunderstanding of the world. The first one is the fact that you think that there is happiness where in fact there is no happiness. This is the first aspect. And of course, as soon as you think that there is happiness out there, craving arises. You want to do something to get that happiness. So you think, okay, I must get out into the world, I must control things and do things in such a way that I get access to this happiness that is available to me, right? This is the first thing. And the second thing of this delusion, which is an important thing, is the fact that the sense of self that you have, this is part of this delusion, tells you that you are in charge, that you can control things. This is what the sense of self is. It's the controller inside. The sense of self tells you, I can control, I can choose, I can do what I want, I can go in a certain way. So it means that you think that you can actually get access to that happiness which is out there. So first of all, you think there is lots of happiness to be had, and secondly, you think you are in charge to control that happiness. And these two things together, these two are called delusions in Buddhism. They're actually a wrong understanding of reality. But these two things together, you can see, if you believe in both of those, it follows as a consequence of those two that you will go into the world and you will start to act for your own benefit. You will start to crave, because if there is happiness to be had, of course, then you will want that happiness. You will desire it. And then you go out and act to try to get hold of that happiness. And in this way, you are creating karma. You're creating, this is what is the will which goes into the world and tries to grab onto these things. This is the second factor of the pen origination, the sankhara. From the ignorance, from the misunderstanding, you go out and you create karma, trying to produce a result for the future. So this is how the ignorance lead you to act in the future. And all of this craving is like looking into the future, right? If you crave for something, it is like saying, sometime in the future, I want to have this particular result. So it's almost like you are projecting yourself into the future. Craving is like a creative force that drives you towards the future. So this is how ignorance leads to this karma, making karma, and then the craving that goes with it. And then that craving making karma, when you do that, of course karma and craving are the things that then lead to rebirth in the future. So this is how it works. So what is it then about this ignorance or this delusion or this illusion that we have? What can be done about that? And to understand what you can do about that, and this of course is very much part of the Buddhist path, is to understand what is it that causes the ignorance to exist in the first place. And this is something that you do find on occasion in the suttas where this is explained very clearly. And it says that the thing that actually causes ignorance, so to speak, in different degrees, is the five hindrances. The five hindrances make that this ignorance or delusion. So the more you have of the five hindrances, right, are sensory desire, ill will, restlessness and worry, and then you have sloth and torpor and doubt in the end. These five things, they are what actually causes the ignorance in you. So the more you have of these hindrances inside of you, the more ignorant in a sense you are, the more deluded you are, the less you see things in accordance to reality. So this is the problem. Why is it that, you know, I've spoken about this many times before, but I think it's probably worthwhile repeating. Why is it that these hindrances cause delusion? What is the mechanism there? And it's really quite simple. When you are upset with somebody, what happens when you're upset with somebody? Sometimes you say things that you don't really want to say. And then afterwards you think, oh, I shouldn't have said that, that was a mistake. So while you're angry, while you're upset, you think this is right to do. So you do it because it seems right. After, when the anger has passed and you feel normal again, then you realize that it was a mistake. So What is happening there is that the anger causes delusion. It causes a wrong understanding of reality here. So anger distorts the mind. It sort of makes a distortion inside of you. And it's exactly the same thing with desire, sensory desire. If you desire something, then often you make mistakes. And the classical one is, of course, typical example is about being faithful, you know, to your partner in life. And sometimes, you know, the temptation is so big to be unfaithful. And then later on, you regret it. At the time, it seemed so right. It seemed the desire convinced you that it was the right thing to do. But afterwards, you regret it because you cause suffering for the people you really love, etc. And then, yeah, you realize the mistake. So again, the desire causes you to see things in a way that is not in accordance with reality. So this is why that these hindrances, and of course, if you are slothful, if you're tired, you know, you can't see clearly, that's very, very obvious. And also restlessness means that the mind is moving a lot, you can't really keep your attention on one thing. That's also not very useful. So all of these things mean that you are deluded, you're not seeing things right. So what we're trying to do on the Buddhist path is reduce these hindrances as much as possible. This is what essentially what this Buddhist path is about. And the more you reduce them, and sometimes you may think that your mind is completely free of the hindrances. You may think, oh, this is a very clear mind state. And then there's a little bit left of something, a little bit of desire left, a little bit of sloth left, whatever. And then you have to clear that as well to gain the full clarity of the mind that is required to kind of overcome the ignorance of the mind. And only when those hindrances are completely gone, are you able to stay completely in the present moment and the mind is clear and delusion and confusion is completely banished. And then that is the time when you can break through the ignorance. Only then do you see clearly and then you can actually see reality as it actually is. So this is what we're trying to do. So maybe interesting also, what causes the five hindrances? This is actually quite a useful thing to think about, what causes the five hindrances. And according to the same sutta that I'm just talking about in the Anguttara Nikaya, I think it is, the Buddha says what causes the five hindrances are the three types of wrong action. The three types of wrong action are wrong action by body, speech and mind, right? So we all know about body and speech, basically. This is like basic Buddhist morality. You are kind through action. You are kind through speech. But the last one is the one that I've been talking about quite a bit on the retreat we've just been having here. And that is the morality of mind. This is a very Buddhist kind of thing. We also have to be moral in the way we think. In other words, not getting upset and angry, not having too many desires that make us do crazy things, etc. This is the morality of the mind. This is a very Buddhist thing here. And actually, we have to practice that morality of mind if we are going to overcome the five hindrances. It's a very important point. It's not sufficient just to practice the morality of speech and body. You also have to practice the morality of mind. This is much more difficult because the mind is so fast, it does all kinds of things. But it is very important, and only then do you really have a chance to eliminate these five hindrances fully and absolutely. This is this of course is the thing that you do when we practice metta and we practice, ways of overcoming anger and all these kind of things. That is when we practice the morality of the mind. So this tells you a lot about the Buddhist path. This is how the Buddhist path works. And then when you have success, and this is how the path works, when you have success in practicing also the morality of the mind, that is when the mindfulness starts to bite. It's only when you have the morality in the mind that mindfulness becomes very powerful. When mindfulness becomes powerful, that is when you can actually practice meditation for the first time. Why is it that meditation is so hard? The reason meditation is so hard is that the mind tends to wander back and forth, think about this, think about that. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. The mind goes back and forth all the time. When you have mindfulness, mindfulness is like a power inside of you. It's like an ability. It's called a faculty. It is something, when you have real mindfulness, you have a sense of being in charge of yourself for the first time. Isn't that a wonderful thing to be in charge of yourself? Usually everything else is in charge of us. We get kind of moved around, like like I like to say, like a ship without a rudder on the ocean, move this way, move that way. When you have mindfulness, you have a sense, I am in charge, not anybody else, not the defilements, not anything else. I can now move my mind where I want to move my mind. And that is why you can meditate. Because if you are in charge, it means that if you want to meditate, if you want to watch the breath, you can actually do that for the first time. Before, when you didn't have mindfulness, the mind was under the influence of the hindrances, whatever, it was impossible. But now that you are in charge, now you can meditate. So that's why mindfulness is so important. So you overcome, you reduce the problems in the mind, you practice morality of the mind, mindfulness becomes stronger. Then when mindfulness is strong, you can focus, you watch the breath, and then the whole path of meditation happens automatically by itself. It is a natural thing. You just sit back and watch, and things just go by themselves. Now, that is the kind of meditation you want. No struggling, just relaxing, just sitting back and feeling good. That is the right kind of meditation. And then meditation becomes joyful and happy. It is all the struggling, all the trying, which is so painful in the meditation practice. And then when a meditation goes well like that, it develops by itself. Eventually, it just develops until you reach a deep state where there are no more hindrances, and then you can see things as they actually are. So this is how this causality, how these things lead to ignorance, and how you actually overcome that problem, that ignorance in the first place. This is how you actually go about this. And then the ignorance starts to disappear, and when the ignorance disappears, then everything, the whole chain of causality also disappears. Everything sort of comes to an end in a beautiful way. So that is how basically how dependent origination works. Let me now recap all those 12 links. Let me now that you have a kind of a general idea of what's going on, let me go through the 12 links one more time in a little bit more detail and see if I can explain a bit better what is going on here. So the first link is ignorance. Ignorance means that you think that there is happiness to be had in the world. Now, in Buddhism it says most of the happiness that we think there is to be had in the world is basically comes from delusion. It's because we don't understand impermanence, we don't understand non-self. So most of these things that seem like happiness, from a different perspective, actually there isn't that much happiness there after all. So we think there's something to be had. That's number one. The second thing, we think we're in charge. Now, thinking you're in charge, this comes from the delusion of the self. The delusion of the self means you think that you can control the world, right? And then you start controlling it. And then when you start doing things based on that delusion, because you think there is happiness, you have craving. Because you think there is happiness to be had, you can control it, you start craving. And then you start doing things on that basis. Now, this doing of things on the basis of craving, this is what is called sankhara. It's the second step of dependent origination. It actually means something like will or volition. So based on the ignorance comes the will to do things in the world. When you do things in the world, you accumulate karma. You accumulate these things, and you can see, let's say that you are very, you know, part of this delusion, if you think that there's a lot of happiness in the world, the more you think that there is happiness in the world, the stronger your craving is, and you will go out and have very powerful craving. When you have very strong craving, very often also, the anger comes with the craving. If you have frustrated craving, you get upset, you feel negative. So you can see here how you, if that delusion is very strong, it means that you create very strong karma, either through anger or through desire. So you make these sankharas that are very powerful. So you create karma in various ways. And when you do that, it's like your mind gets established in accordance with the karma you're making. So if you do a lot of bad karma, your mind gets established in the low place. If you do a lot of good karma, your mind gets established in the high place. And then when you die, it's like consciousness is in that place that you created for it during this life. And this is called like a station of consciousness in Buddhism. So your consciousness gets stationed in a certain place, in a low place, in a high place, in a medium place, whatever it is. And when that consciousness is stationed there, then you will experience a certain range of feelings, a certain range of experiences that are the limits are set by the station of that consciousness. So you have a certain range. So if you are a human being, there's usually a certain range of feelings, right? You can eat Indian food, or you can eat McDonald's, or you can eat, you know, the very high kind of class food. There's a certain range of foods that you can have as a human being. And there's a certain range of entertainment. There are bad movies, and there are very good movies, but there's a certain limit to that range. And so it is for every different class of rebirth. There's a certain range of experience. If you are born as a kangaroo in Australia, all you get is grass all the time. All you have to eat is grass. Imagine that. It's a terrible thing to have to eat grass all the time. It's wonderful when you give food, human food, to the kangaroo. It's like a spark goes on in their eyes. Wow, this is amazing. They get a piece of chocolate and you see the light, they bright up for the first time. That's what happens when you have to eat grass all the time. So the thing is that you have that range, that normal range for you, depending on where you are reborn. And if you have a very high rebirth, that range has a very high, you know, the content is very beautiful of that range. So that is the range of experience, and part of that experience is not just it's the feelings, it's the perceptions, it's also the will. You will in a certain way, depending on where you are reborn. So your whole world is formed by the place you are reborn. Everything you experience is formed by that. So once consciousness is established in a certain place, basically you are stuck there, and you have to have the consequences. So you might as well do some good karma so you get stuck in a good place, otherwise you have a problem. If you're going to be stuck anyway, might as well enjoy being stuck where you are. So this is how essentially this works. You are in that place. Of course, as a human being, things are a little bit more you have certain advantages as a human being, because as a human being, it's true that if you live an ordinary life, you are fairly stuck within a certain limit of feelings. But as a human being, you can take a spiritual path, right? You can practice meditation, and you can actually experience things that ordinary human beings don't. And this is where the happiness through meditation and all these things come into the picture. So there is, in a sense, as a human, there is a sense of escape. You can escape to some degree the limits of the human experience through these kind of methods. But then when you come out of meditation, well, you're back into the human body again, and you have your limits again. So once you have set that range of experience according to where you get reborn, then your senses will tend to experience things in a certain way. As a human being, you experience the world in a certain way. And it's very interesting, if you read what scientists have to say about animals, they will say that an animal actually experiences the world in a very different way from how we experience the world. They experience much more fear, they see things in a different way, there may be certain colors they cannot see. It's a very different experience of the world. If you are an insect, for example, you know, when you look at an insect, they seem to have eyes, they seem to have roughly the same senses as we have, but actually what they see through those eyes they have is very different from what we see through our human eyes. So again, the point is that your experience of the world, the six senses, are very different depending on where your consciousness has been established. And because of that, because your senses are different, the way that you contact the world is also very different. So your experience of contacting the world and the pleasures and the thing that come as a consequence of that will vary enormously depending on where you are. But regardless of where you are, there will be a certain degree of pleasure, a certain degree of pain, and a certain degree of neutral feelings. And as I was saying before, once these things exist, once there is such a thing as pain and pleasure and neutrality, craving comes as a consequence of that, right? When you have a pleasant feeling, you want that. When you have an unpleasant feeling, you want to get rid of it. Craving is a consequence of feeling. Once you have feeling, you must crave. Then when you crave, you start to think, well, how can I ensure that my cravings get satisfied in life? And a lot of the things that we do in life are precisely about satisfying our cravings. Why do we have, like, relationships? Why do we get married? Why do we have jobs? Why do we choose a certain religion? Why are you Buddhists, for example? It's because you think that Buddhism is going to give you some happiness, right? If you thought Buddhism was going to give you just misery and suffering, you would not become a Buddhist. You are here because you think it's going to give you something positive. That's why I am a Buddhist anyway. So I'm a Buddhist because I think this is something which is going to be positive for my life. Why do people have certain political views? Why do they have views about anything for that matter? Where do our views come from? We take these things up and we hold on to them, we become attached to them, certain ways of looking at the world, because we think by grasping onto this, by doing this, we will be able to satisfy our craving. And this is what attachment is all about. This is what that clinging is all about. This thing called upadana in Pali. Taking things up, doing all these things, because we think in this way we will be able to satisfy things. And you can see why attachments then are so hard to let go of. If you have the most wonderful partner in the world, a great husband or a great wife, you become attached to that person. Why? Because they are a source of satisfying your craving. In many different ways, friendship, closeness, all these needs that we have as human beings. And that is why the attachments are so hard to let go, because there is a great sense of satisfaction that comes through these attachments. And then when you attach, when you hold on to the world in a certain way, when you have certain views about things, when you have this even includes ideas about the self inside, who you are as a person, when you take up a certain religion, all these kind of things, these are like the strategies for satisfying our craving. When you have all that, then you live in a certain way, you have a certain type of existence in accordance to these things, how you take up things. And then when you have a certain type of existence, this is called bhava in Pali, that existence means you create kamma in accordance with that existence. How you live decides what sort of kamma that you're making. And when you make kamma in a certain way, combined with craving, then you get reborn as a consequence of that in the particular state. This is jati, this is birth, what I was talking about before. And then when you are born, then you will have to suffer the consequences of birth, which is old age and death in the future, suffering in life. That is a consequence of birth. So that is basically dependent origination. The main point of dependent origination, it shows you that if you are ignorant, if you don't understand things the way they are, you will crave. You will crave for what you think is happiness out there, and you will try to control the world in your way. So you will create kamma. Now that craving is like a creative force that once you die, it will create a new rebirth for you. You will get reborn in accordance with the kamma, and the craving will support you in that new life and sort of bring you forward in a new life. So ignorance leads to rebirth. As long as there is rebirth, you will have to suffer in the future. Ignorance, rebirth, suffering. But then, when you do the opposite, when you see that a way of cutting through that ignorance by purifying yourself, by getting rid of this misunderstanding of reality, then you stop craving for this kind of illusion that is out there. Because you stop craving, you don't actually make any kamma for future rebirth. When you don't make any kamma, you don't have any craving, there's no rebirth happening. When there's no rebirth, you cannot suffer in the future. So this is dependent origination. I told you it's very profound, so I'm not even sure if I understand it myself fully sometimes. That is how profound it is. But one thing I should say, and it is very profound also, because it talks about ending rebirth. For most of us, ending rebirth is like, it is like something very hard to understand. It is very difficult to understand. But the point is that actually dependent origination is not just about ending rebirth. It's also when you reduce the ignorance at the beginning, because this is a causal chain, and that ignorance goes through the whole chain. By reducing ignorance, that effect of reducing ignorance goes through the whole chain, all the way up to suffering. So if you reduce ignorance, you actually reduce suffering. So if you practice in a good way, if you purify yourself, if you become a better person, if you have less anger in the world, if you have more compassion and kindness to the people around you. What you're doing, you're creating less suffering for yourself in the future. You're actually not just purifying your mind, but you are reducing the suffering in your life. So it is a very immediate and practical consequence right there of dependent origination. So, okay, I think that is enough actually for now. So,
sadhu. Ajahn, I suffer the most when my wife stopped talking to me. I don't know whether she practiced noble silence. Okay, to end your suffering, start asking questions.
Ajahn Brahmali, I'm Fanny. While you were talking about people searching for happiness, and while they are searching, they then create karma through their actions. And recently I attended a cousin who is just remarried, and in my wishes I said, may you find the happiness that you're searching for, which means that I'm actually asking him to create more karma. Should I then say, may you see the light, or, you know, can you hope that you'll see the suffering? My question is the mind inherently unstable that causes us to constantly want to cling on to something, either a belief or maybe some material things to strengthen it? And in the course of meditation, does it strengthen our mind to allow us to see that we don't need all these things to cling on to? That's my question. Thanks.
Okay. So is the mind inherently unstable? And does meditation kind of solidify so you don't actually need to cling onto things anymore? Yes, I think there's a lot of truth in that. It is in many ways inherently unstable. It is inherently unstable in the sense that it's always changing. It is always moving back and forth. This is on many different levels, but certainly on a very ordinary level as a human being. You just look inside your mind and you see how, you know, incredibly unstable it is. It doesn't have to be quite that unstable, but that is certainly part of the problem. Is that the reason why we cling? The clinging really comes, I think that's part of it, because the instability means that sometimes you have good feelings, sometimes you have bad feelings, and that instability means that craving arises when there is a change in these kind of things, right? So instability must also, in a sense, lead to craving in the future, because you lose what you had. Oh, I had happiness before, now it's gone. Dukkha instead. So that is a very important part of it. It's called the viparinama dukkha in Pali, the dukkha due to change. So that is part of it. And I think one of the most important things here is what I was mentioning before, is that if you practice the path, and this is what happens, is that you start to get a certain stability inside of yourself. You get a sense that you are in charge of your own life. This doesn't mean that you will always be satisfied or always happy. But the idea is, with mindfulness, is that you can suddenly guide your kind of your interaction with the world. And because you guide your interaction with the world, because you have a sense of taking your mind in the right way, that means that you start to feel that there isn't such a big problem anymore with things. So that is part of it. But it is not the whole thing. In the end, the most profound thing about attachment is simply the sense of self inside. You have a feeling that you exist, you have a feeling that I am, this is just a natural part of being a human being. So because of that, you tend to attach to the idea of a self. I exist, and you attach to that. And that is despite any instability or whatever else. This very sense of self is actually part of the kind of deep-rooted problem inside of us. And that is, in the end, the thing that we have to sort out. And this is the thing that ignorance always points back to is the sense of self inside of us. And only then is it really possible to overcome attachment. It's not just about instability, it's about the sense of self. The sense of self is what creates attachment in the world. And one of the things I think which is important, which I like to point out to people, is that sometimes people say, oh, you know, I should be a good Buddhist, and because I should be a good Buddhist, I shouldn't attach to things. And people say, I shouldn't attach. But the point is that you have no choice in this matter. It's not as if you can choose and say, I'm not going to attach anymore. Because you have a sense of self, you must attach. This is part and parcel of being a human being, that you will attach. So because it is part and parcel of being a human being, what you have to do instead is to try to find ways of attaching that in a sense are skillful. So as, you know, I mean, as a human being, you have to have friends. We all need to have friends in life. So you choose good friends. You know, you come to the Buddhist fellowship, or you have friends that actually guide you in the right direction, etc., etc. So you try to sort of guide yourself onto new attachments. Instead of being immoral, you attach yourself to some degree to morality, to being kind, to being generous, to being a good person. There might be a degree of attachment there, but it is a good type of attachment, and it leads you in the right direction. So we accept as humans that we're going to have attachments. So let's try to move those attachments in such a way that it leads us in the right direction. It's like a ladder. It's a ladder of attachments. In the beginning, you're very low on the ladder. You cling on to something, and that which you cling on to is not very good. And then you realize, actually, I can cling on to something which is a little bit higher. So you cling on to that instead. And then you let go of that, and you move up the ladder, and you attach to things that are more and more refined. And eventually, you can actually let go of those attachments altogether. And that happens when you see through the sense of self. It is the sense of self that attaches. It's not just the uncertainty in the world. It is this fundamental ground delusion that is there all the time. And this is what makes Buddhism, Buddhism. Buddhism is precisely the religion, or the, maybe not religion is a good word, but it is the life kind of philosophy, which the only one, in fact, I think, which denies that there is a self in the end, that there's actually we are empty of any kind of permanent entity inside of us. So I'm not sure if I have even answered your question. Do you want to come back on that one, or are you happy with that? Yeah. You've reflect on it. Okay, very good.
Ajahn, I have two questions over here. One is, are there different types of jhana? The other one is, how does generosity help to get rid of greed?
Okay, so how does generosity help to get rid of greed? Okay, well, the first thing, if you give something, obviously you can't hold on to that, you've got to get rid of it. So, you know, it helps you in that sense to get rid of greed. You're giving up something which is yours. That is the first part. But I think, more importantly, the most important thing about generosity is not so much that it, you know, gets rid of greed straight away, but that it is a factor of the path. When you give something, you feel happiness inside, you feel goodness inside, and it helps you in your practice, it helps you in your meditation practice. It takes you to a new level, so to speak. And that is why, that is, I think, the main reason why generosity is so important. It doesn't actually, you cannot really overcome greed just by giving your stuff away, but it is the change in mental attitude that comes around over a long period of time that gradually takes you away from self-centeredness. There's something about greed, you're very focused on yourself. If instead you look at the needs of other people, that is part of it. You're looking outside. What do other people need? It takes your focus onto other people rather than yourself. This is one of the important aspects of this thing we call generosity here. So I think that is part of the answer. What was the other question here?
Are there different types of jhana?
Are there different type of jhana? There are four jhanas. Is that what you mean? There are four jhanas. There are different ways of describing the jhanas. This is an interesting area. How do we know which teachings are right and which teachings are wrong, right? One of the very difficult things in Buddhism, you can read one book, one person says one thing, another person says something else. And this can be about a broad range of topics within Buddhism. And this is certainly true about the jhanas. Some people say, oh, jhana is like this, somebody else says it's like that. So how do we know who is right? And in the end, the only real way you can find out is that you have to practice yourself. And as you progress on the path, you start to get a feel for how this path works, what is right and what is wrong. That is really the ideal way here. But of course, the most important way for most people is to have some understanding of Buddhism, is actually to read what the Buddha said about these things. Okay, so this person says that, that person says that. Let's see what the Buddha said. But even that is actually quite difficult, because you read what the Buddha said, and then you think you know what he said, and actually you get it wrong. Yeah. So it actually is, the whole thing is quite tricky, and this is the problem with it. So in the end, I think one of the things about Buddhism that makes a person a Buddhist is that you have some sort of confidence in this path. How does that confidence arise? And this is, I think, a very important issue. What is the difference between somebody who has, like, faith and confidence and somebody who doesn't have that? And I think one of the important distinctions is that real, true confidence comes when you see a person, somebody who is different from what you're used to. You see somebody who you think, gee, this is abnormal. People are not usually like that. And then when you see that, something inside of you says that something has happened here, which ordinary people do not have. Some of the qualities of this person, I would be very keen on getting some of those qualities, because these are obviously very good qualities to have. And this is how true confidence in Buddhism actually arises. And of course, once you have confidence in somebody, once you have a sense that this person has something special, then we will tend to take the teachings of that person as being authoritative to a certain extent. And then you will tend to read the suttas in line with, at least with the help of that person, to understand what is happening here. And then over time, what you should ideally do then, you should read the suttas, you should listen to somebody you think has authority about these things, and then over time you start to come to an understanding yourself. You follow the same path, you have some of the same experiences, and eventually you come to the point where you can decide whether that person you took as having authority, whether they really were right or wrong, whether it was what they're saying actually is true or not. And then you have a strong sense of confidence inside of yourself that this is actually correct, this is right. So this is the problem, and this is, I must admit, is one of those things that I have, when I read the suttas, I always ask myself, well, who actually is right? You know, if two different people say two different things about jhanas, I feel I have to sort it out. You know, what is going on here? You want to understand what this teaching is about. And this is, I think, the right way of going about it. I'm sometimes very concerned. I meet people who have no confidence whatsoever in Buddhism. I meet people who have read all the suttas, and then they reject everything and saying it's just a nonsense, a whole bunch of beliefs. It's no different from any other religion, and it's just complete stupidity. Why would anybody believe this? And I think, why is it that I have such confidence in the teachings, and they have no confidence? We have both read the suttas, we read the same word, and yet we have reacted very differently. And the main reason, I think, is because I feel I have seen that this path actually works. I have seen people that when I look at them, I think, wow, what happened here? Something has happened here. Something unusual has happened. Something worthy of respect, worthy of confidence. And for that reason, that is why I have confidence and they don't. And that is the difference. And that is a very important difference. And when you read the suttas, you see that the Buddha, this is what the Buddha says, this is how confidence comes about. You look at the person, and when you see exceptional qualities, that is when the confidence arises. And what is so beautiful about the Buddha's teachings, he says the same thing about himself. He says, you should look at me here, and you should investigate me, and see if you see anything worthy for which you should reject me. Do you see any anger in me? Do you see any desire? Do you see any delusion? And watch me for a long period of time. And when you do that, hopefully you will then be convinced that there is no defilements in the Buddha. If there is, then he's not the Buddha.
Okay, I think we've got to stop here because Ajahn got to go for his lunch. Should there be any other question? Ajahn, is it okay to see you after? So Ajahn says it's okay. You can see him after lunch. It should be 12:30. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we did say sadhu and